What's up, Culture Hackers? It's Robbie Richmond here for your Culture Hackers podcast. We're going to have a really fun, interesting episode today because we are with Andrew Waller and Mike Gagerman. Welcome, guys.
Hey, Robbie. How's it going?
Thanks for having us.
So happy to be here in these Hollywood studios of yours. And the context for everyone, this is weird because when was the last time we even really hung out? 20 years ago?
I saw you walking your dog the other day.
That spurred it, but before this.
I would say you and I would have hung out maybe 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Because you guys were college buddies.
That's Mike, right. And I went to college together, and the three of us went to Brentwood High School together, and we were all on the Brentwood Flyer newspaper staff, which was a really fun experience.
It was a seminal paper.
Yes. It was auspicious.
Award-winning, even. No, didn't we get some kind of awards?
I can't imagine I won an award. I mean, but it was a solid paper. I went and read one of my old articles. I was not impressed.
We did at least go to national conferences.
That's true. We went to Columbus, Ohio. I remember that.
We were nominated. I think perhaps.
I think everyone was nominated.
Did you get trashed with us that night where we all like literally we got bought a whole bunch of 40s and got drunk in the hotel room? That was a really brutal.
That was a tough next morning.
Yeah, that was hard.
We had to do some like roundtable discussions about high school papery.
Ethics and journalism.
Right.
Was not. I think I skipped the 41.
You were just like, you know what? I don't need any charcoal filtering. At a Best Western in Columbus, Ohio.
Those were fun days. I think we thought we were a lot cooler than we were, but it still worked.
I knew we weren't cool.
Yeah.
But I thought, you know, we were counterculture or something.
Yeah.
And we definitely were not.
I mean, we knew all of the words to Nothing But a G Thing.
That's true.
That was something.
That felt cool. It wouldn't have looked cool.
I can't believe how many weekends we spent in front of those Macintosh 2LEs,
yeah.
Like waiting for that. Remember that refresh rate on it to redesign a page?
Mm.
Like that probably would take an hour today, what we had to do in a weekend.
Right. Yeah. And it was, yeah, we really would spend the whole weekend there for something that nobody read. The only issue anyone read was the fake issue, right?
Right.
Which was like us trying to do The Onion.
We were like ahead of The Onion, yeah.
Yeah.
If only we continued with that and only did parody issues, like we would have been famous.
Also, if we had gotten jobs at Amazon or Google.
That would have been another way to go.
That would have been the thing to do. Graduate in 97, but let's go into entertainment as opposed to the internet. That seems like a weird call.
Oh, yeah. I went after that into magazines, print magazines, rather than the internet. Even though I had an internet version of it, I said, no. All the real glory is in a print magazine.
Oh, internet's a fad,
man. Oh, such a fad. In fact, when Amazon IPO'd, my dad asked me, he said, should I try to get in on this IPO? Mm. And I specifically said, I use it, but no one else will. Those were my words of advice to my dad on investing in Amazon.
There's actually a famous quote of another friend of ours from high school, Brian Lim, who was also on that paper, who was going into internet and was recruited by Amazon coming out of college before it was a thing. And his quote on why he wasn't going to take that job was, bookstore on the web, how whack.
Was he quoted in an article about that? Or just to you guys?
We remind him of it every year. Some years he actually thinks it's funny. Other years he's like, come on, dude, that's not funny.
And now the Robbie Richmond podcast universe also knows the story.
Oh my God, it's going to be exciting when he gets this in Melbourne. He's in Melbourne. He's an economics professor at the University of Melbourne.
Hi, Lim.
Well, we will definitely have to send this to him. So where are we? Are these a bunch of writer studios? Where are we right now?
So we're in a building called the Hollywood Production Center.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like a potpourri of entertainment-related things. There are a lot. There are like editing suites. There are some writers' rooms for like TV shows. And then there's a couple people like us that just have individual little offices.
Yeah.
It tends to be a kind of temporary home for a lot of productions, pre-production, post-production kind of thing. We've been here for – we're probably the longest-running tenants. We've been here for maybe 6 years.
Well, I'm a super fan. I've not seen any of your stuff, but I'm a super fan. And you guys must be funny, because when I got here and I just said I'm here for Waller, the receptionist literally started cracking up. And then the second one said Waller time, and then they started cracking up. So you guys must just be the funniest people here.
Well, we do treat this, even though obviously our whole company is just Mike and I, mm-hmm. we do treat this as like an office where we're like the guys at the water cooler, like trying to gossip with the people who have no idea who we are. So we try to make our presence. I really love an office environment, mm-hmm. and but as screenwriters, you don't really get that very much, you know? It's very rare that you're kind of surrounded by, I mean, surrounded by anybody but Mike.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're thinking of getting cubes just because it would make Andrew happy.
And an intern would be nice, some sort of an intern. Anybody listening? Hey, want to be our intern?
Got it, yeah. So, so last week you guys couldn't do the podcast because you were doing a pitch, right?
Yes.
How'd the pitch go?
You know what? It actually, was that the one? What was that one? That was the one that got pushed till Friday. It's actually this Friday.
Yeah, we haven't done
now.
That pitch yet. Oh, but we did end up spending last week finishing a second draft of a TV pilot that we're writing.
Okay. And is this one of those Hollywood secret things where if you say it, somebody could hear this podcast and steal the idea, or can you actually share something?
I mean, we could share some of the stuff that we're doing. We are working on a script called One Night Six Parties, and it's about, well, you can imagine, it's about a bunch of guys who end up going to six parties in a night.
Right. So hot tub time machine meets four weddings and a funeral.
Exactly. Oh, that's not bad. I see it. I see what he's going for. Yeah, it's just it ends up being, you know, just guys going to crazy parties in New York, and us coming up with different crazy ways for
and
that.
There's no time travel in it, although now I'm thinking maybe there should be.
Yeah, are you guys going to do some research on this in New York and actually go deep cover into the party scene?
That would have been a smart thing to do before we wrote it, but
now I don't know that our wives would be like, wait, I thought you already turned that script in.
Yeah.
I don't really think you should be going to a fetish party in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure it would have been better. I think the fetish party scene actually worked out pretty well just with our imaginations, but
it's probably better. I mean, remember watching those John Hughes films and all the parties that would be going on there, and you just so wanted to be at it, and then you went to a real high school party, and it was like, what is this? This is nothing like I've seen in the movies.
Right.
So your parties are probably much better.
I hope so.
In the movie.
We like a nice hyper-real aspect to what's going on. Like, I don't want... We're not the guys who write the stuff that looks exactly like your life. We're hoping it looks better than your life.
Right.
We're hoping that you're going to go to the movie and be like, oh, I recognize that character as being me, but in a much more awesome situation.
Got it.
Aspirational you.
Yes.
And how do these pitches work? Are you just sitting in there bullshitting, talking about it? Do you play a soundtrack? Do you act it out right in front of them? Like,
I love the soundtrack idea.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, so the pitches, they tend to be fairly rehearsed. It's us somewhat trying to act. We don't tend to do a lot of characters. Occasionally, if we have a really like killer line, we might try to dip into a character, but it's not a strength. The pitch feels like us dancing for 15 to 20 minutes, breathlessly trying to tell a story and keep it entertaining, and then it's over.
Do you look for like visual cues, like if they just start looking down, or if they like, and then you have to switch it up and get their attention back, or like what's going on a nuanced level in those pitch meetings?
Oh, yikes. If I see them looking down or there's a yawn, that like just all that does is just set off like a huge amount of anxiety in my head.
Because you have to finish it. So, right. So you just, what happens is you end up speeding up in a way that's really not helpful, because you get in your head like, oh, this is tanking. We need to get through this faster, which just makes it worse. So once that spiral starts, you're just kind of fucked.
It sounds like a bad date.
Yeah. Mm. I haven't been on a date in a long time, but that sounds about right.
Well, I think it starts with, you know, of like, so, you know, Mike and I'll have a kernel of an idea, right? And then we'll just start fleshing it out, right? So in this office, we start talking about, oh yeah, wouldn't it be funny if, you know, if this guy, you know, got into trouble in this way? If he went down the script that got made, Mike had this idea like, oh, wouldn't it be funny if your, you know, buddy called from Mexico saying, I'm naked on a road in Mexico. You guys got to come get me. And then it becomes the discussion of, well, you're the two friends who get that phone call. What's the first thing that has to happen? Well, we have to get in our car, but what if the car's not starting? Where do we have to go there? We have to get cash. So we go to the Indian casino and what happens there? And we sort of build that out into, you know, like into a bigger kind of story structure idea, three act story structure with all these characters. And then converting that into pitch form can be a whole nother thing because you actually need to tell that whole story in a really condensed form.
You have to tell the whole story in a way that connects emotionally without telling all the beats of the story, but enough of the beats that they can figure out everything that happens.
Yeah.
But it still has to be unique and interesting and not obvious.
Right.
So it's a difficult line to toe.
Yeah.
You tend to want to start with sort of more broad kind of conceptual things. Even if it's essentially a dumb road comedy, they want to know that it's about something, and they want to know what the kernel of truth in that is.
Yeah, and is it interactive? Are they asking questions and talking to you through it, or are you just dance monkey dance the whole time?
So when it's going well, it's interactive. Those are the best pitches.
Yeah,
and I think you know we're really curious when we talk to other writers because we don't really get to see other people pitch, so we don't really know what it looks like for everyone. We only know what it looks like for us.
Mm.
It can often be the dance monkey dance version, which is the one that doesn't go as well because they're not engaged. Because so right. we try to structure it in such a way that there's space, that there's room to breathe for them to ask questions.
Yeah.
Because those are the ones that are more conversational are the ones that go better.
Totally. Yeah, and the weird thing is the dance monkey dance is more our fault than theirs. Mm-hmm. That when we craft a pitch, we're alone in this room. It's really tough to anticipate what the questions are going to be. So we tend to put together almost like a story that we're telling, almost like you would tell a story to your kids. And as a result, we want to get from one beat to the next, and we're not leaving as much space for them to interact. So we work on it. We try to figure out ways to open up where we can, okay, we can pause here, and this will give them an opportunity to interact. And, and the ones that are dance monkey dance are because for whatever reason, we've structured it in a weird way where there's no opportunity for them to come in.
Yeah. Have you heard of this book called How to Pitch Anything?
Mm-mm.
It's by Oren Clough. I think it's this guy who pitches just $100 million deals just all the time. And he wrote this book about his process and it's fascinating. And he compares the whole thing and says the best pitches are flirting. Uh-huh. That you like flirt, and that's the whole interaction. And he talks about how the most important attention in a pitch isn't passion, it's energy, it's attention. And if you hold their attention, and so he's got these fascinating stories where he'll lose their attention. One time he saw a guy like drawing his hand as he's talking, you know, and rather than continuing the speech, he just stops and goes, "Wow, that's an awesome hand painting there. Like, I want to buy that. How much?" And then they start negotiating over the price of the hand painting. And, like, he brings back the meeting. So he's totally just in this almost martial art form of, like, just going to go with whatever's in the room as opposed to his agenda.
Yeah, that would actually...
That's ballsy.
Yeah, no, I also think it would... I also think in a lot of ways it would work. We tend to do things like prepare... We prepare chatter, right? We prepare when we go in there, hey, what happened... You know, what happened on Monday? Oh, there was the Vanity Fair cover with Caitlyn Jenner. That's going to be a topic of conversation that can start a conversation. What happened with Deflategate? Like, during, you know, like you can, because if you have a funny perspective or a fun perspective on that, which we should have because we're supposed to be funny writers, we should be doing, you know, we should be trying to steer the conversation that way. So it starts as kind of a fun,
right?
This is a fun, hey, we might as well be out of drinks. We're just talking. Oh, and by the way, we have this idea and it's about these two guys and this is a fun thing that happens.
Yeah, there's always this beginning part of the meeting that is, I guess you could call it a flirtation. That's accurate. Where it's like, what's been going on? What are you guys up to? Right. Did you see this? And you were hoping to set a tone and get everybody, you know, in a laughing mood. And then at some point somebody says, okay, so we're here to talk about whatever. And then, you know, and then that's our cue to to presumably launch into the pitch.
Right.
And then sometimes when we're doing it well, it will feel of the same tone as the conversation. And when we're not doing it well, all of a sudden we feel like newscasters just reading off of a story that they have no connection to.
Yeah. So what would you do next time that happens? If you're in that mode and you feel like you're in newscaster mode, like what would you do right then?
Usually we have not developed the skill to break from it because you are in the middle of a story you have to finish.
Right.
There is, I've caught myself in it and I've just tried to get myself to slow down. Mm.
Slowing down is a big one.
There's been the occasional sort of ad lib, you know, because we do essentially we take turns, right? We pass it back and forth to each other. And there are times where we've been able to sort of ad lib jokes that are more off the cuff, off of what Andrew's saying, where I might think of a way to jump in with something. And if I jump in, it could make the listener more comfortable jumping in.
Yeah.
But, you know, the other, you know, one of the biggest X factors is everybody you pitch to is different and receives pitches in different ways.
Right.
Some people laugh and they give you a lot. So when you're making jokes, you feel better about it. And some people have, you know, what they call listening faces, where they're just sitting there with their notebook and they're really concentrating and figuring out the story. When you're pitching comedy, that's really hard because you feel like you're dying.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, I think we, for whatever reason, we lean on being very, very prepared. Like, and so we know, like, if a producer knows that if they're going in with us to a bunch of networks or a bunch of studios, we're gonna deliver the pitch, all of the characters, they're going to know, we're going to walk out of the room and everybody's going to get what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Now, whether or not they want to buy that, that's another thing. One of the things that other people do is it's a little more unpredictable. And then you're not sure for those people if they're going to be able to translate the entire thing, you know, in the room, but it might be a little bit more of a fun room. And our goal recently has been to try to bridge that gap a little bit, but it's a tough one because we do want to be polished.
Right, right. So in your office here, like, you guys are two writers, it's your own company. Do you come in every day at 9 a.m.? Is there a work schedule? Like, how do you go about that?
There is. We have our hours. Like, we tend to drop the kids off at school, so we get in between 9 and 9:30. And often have to be, you know, depending on what, you know, whatever the politics in the house is at the time, who's going to be home with kids. So we do tend to work like essentially a 9 to 6 regular hours. We're then often in on weekends, sometimes nights, or working from home. There's no reason why we have to be in the office.
Right. Well, so one of the things that's happening in the workplace now is millennials really want a flexible work environment.
We have. I mean, we do.
Right. So I think part of it, you know, people can say is whiny and entitled, but I think part of it makes sense in that, you know, there are sometimes at 3 in the afternoon where I'm worthless and I think I should be not doing work because I could do harm. You know, like, right. I think it goes in flows. And I would think, especially with the creative process, that you're not just on 9 to 6. Like, do you not ever see cycles and flows to be like, you know what, it's afternoon, 4 o'clock, like, we're not hitting it, let's just not do this or do something else? Or
that, no, so that happens a lot. And I will say that one of the reasons why I wanted to be a writer was for the flexible hours,
right,
and to not be in an office.
Right.
And then it's as I've gotten older and as my life has gotten more structured, I've craved more of that structure. And yes, we have those days, we have those weeks where we're sitting in the office, but we're just surfing and nothing's getting done. And sometimes we're like, let's go see a movie, and that can help to break up the day, or let's take a walk. I will say, though, if without some structure, I don't think you'd get anything done.
Right.
You sometimes, even when you're not hitting it creatively, your job is to just sit there and get something down that you can work from and fix later. That you can't just work when you feel like it, because you won't do enough.
Mm. Yeah, I think the most unfortunate thing is, I think if somebody like you followed us around for 3 months, you might be able to actually restructure what we do to maximize what we do in a lot better way, because I think we are consistent in a lot of our inconsistencies. So like there, the way we put a pitch together, you might be able to say, guys, this is what you do. You guys stress out for 3 days, get nothing done, and then on the fourth day, you jam it out. So why not just,
right?
You know, why not just take those 3 days and go enjoy yourself? Mm-hmm. And then,
or work on something else.
Yeah, and then know on that fourth day, you got to come in and really power it. Like, you were able to do it. I don't know that those 3 days of not working helped.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, I think that happens. I mean, I think some people are able to structure that in where they decide, oh, you know, my creative process is I'm reading a book and in the shower, something will come to me. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that we've, you know, structured our work life to be able to allow for.
Right. So what do you guys find interesting or unique about the Hollywood culture that our listeners wouldn't know from watching TV, from watching E, from like what are some of the deeper, maybe darker things that you've realized working here that you wouldn't have expected?
I mean, it feels like a very hard job, like a harder job than I think I would have imagined.
Like people would think it's easier.
I definitely think people would think it's easier. I would definitely think people would think, hey, you know, you write a good script, you're in good shape. And there's a lot of other factors to that because you could write a good script and they could not be looking for that kind of script at that kind of time.
Or you could be in good shape for that moment, but then the next thing you write isn't as well received and now you're in bad shape because you've lost it.
Right.
You know, so that you're sort of only doing as well as your last thing.
Well, how much does that change given that there's so many opportunities now to create your own stuff, to be on YouTube, and is it still that there's just this big gate that the studios have that they control your life, or are you able to have now new avenues to go about creatively?
So I think it depends. I think there are new avenues. I think it's almost like a separate it's how much you let the studios control it. It all depends on what game you're playing. Mm-hmm. If you're playing in the studio game, it does tend to look the same as it always did. It's still a pretty traditional route. The people who are finding these new avenues are essentially just doing that on their own, and that's smart.
Right.
Because you should be playing sort of in both sandboxes.
And people are much more impressed if you're the type of person who can do something if you don't need them. Right. Like if you're somebody who makes your own, you know, movies on your own, if you find your own financing, you're going to be more interesting to a lot more people than if you're going to be reliant on, you know.
Speaking of financing.
Yeah.
Relativity.
Right.
Sure.
What's his name?
Ryan Kavanaugh.
Yeah. Ryan Kavanaugh, who we all knew, like, we would never expect would have turned out, and like,
I mean, it's amazing. Yeah, he's done an incredible thing, and you know,
so for everybody not understanding, can you just say what Relativity is?
Well, no, it's just one in like a new studio and sort of a new era. I mean, there hadn't been a kind of a big new studio in a long time, and this guy we went to high school with, who was in our class, you know, found a way to creatively finance movies and became a real, you know, kind of powerhouse in the industry.
Didn't they say he had some type of formula too that like that they could predict how movies were going to do based on some algorithm?
There was a sort of sense, I think, in the early days that was part of how he was. I think that was, there was some marketing in that. I mean, because I think his background was in finance, and in the same way that there is a lot of those formulas that, you know, people in Wall Street used to say the reason why their hedge fund is going to perform better than other hedge funds is because they. So I do think there was, I do know that there was talk of a formula. I don't know if it was real, if it was marketing, if it was something that he said that people latched on to. But really, they've just operated very sort of smartly. They've found ways to, like Andrew said, creatively finance and get themselves involved with.
What does that mean? Does that mean they found private investors for movies when that didn't happen before?
Yeah, right. There's that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little unclear on the details, but from what it sounded like, it had originally started that he was finding people to. The studios at some point did not want to finance their own movies, right? They wanted to find outside private equity to help them finance their movies, and so he would
mitigate risk.
Yeah, and so he was the guy very early on who was the guy who could find that money, and so then he was able to get in the rooms with all of the sort of studio players because they wanted that access to that money, and then he was able to use that to parlay it into his own studio.
Yeah. And did you ever call him up and say, throw me a bone here?
Well, we have hung out with him a little bit, not very much. we haven't worked with them yet.
And on some level, I mean, he's very open to hanging out. On some level, when you're a studio head, there's only so much you can do. You know what I mean? Like,
it's almost like he's too big.
He's too big to help us. Right, because he's not the guy that you walk into the room and pitch to and he buys it, because those guys all report to him.
Right.
I think if we had something and brought it to them, he's somebody that we could reach out to and say, hey, by the way, we're going to be pitching to your guys, and it couldn't hurt. Mm-hmm. But in a way, it's more helpful to have the guys who are the ones that you're pitching to, who are a little lower down the ladder.
Yeah, got it. And so, how much do you think drugs are involved in Hollywood? Like, I remember reading the stories about Seth Rogen and just being a whole set of fog in his office of smoking constantly.
Well, the greatest thing was when I sort of started. I was like a PA on movie sets in like the late 90s. And everybody would talk about the sweet years, right? Like that they were, that in the 80s, it was like there was a grip on every grip truck who was the guy to get the coke for everybody. And like everybody was getting the B12 shot. But it was sort of clear even in 1998 that those days were behind them. That like somehow the culture had changed away from that. So yeah, if there is... I mean, I would say if there's like, weed and prescription pills and stuff like that, it's all kind of vaguely medicinal and not really, I don't know that there's a lot. I mean, nobody's partying in the way that they used to in those great 70s and 80s stories.
Or everybody is. I mean, I think there are plenty of lawyers who have their medicinal weed and go on lunch break and get high. Like, I think in a way it's... Hollywood is like a lightning rod for that kind of attention and for those kind of questions. But, I mean, sort of everybody sort of smokes weed at this point.
Right.
The Seth Rogen stuff, there's probably some truth to that. I'm sure they do, in fact, get high in their office. But, we haven't seen that.
And it's fucking miserable for me. It doesn't help. Like, if I have one drink, the day's done.
I think they would all say that you just have to do it more and practice and really get good at it, and that you're just not good at it.
I did.
You got to put in your 10,000 hours.
Yeah, there was a screenwriter at a thing I've always wanted to try where he said that, if you get stuck on at some point in the screenplay, which happens a lot, you just get stuck. You can't see your way through the problems that you're having. And what he does is he would sit down, he gets a cooler that he puts right next to his desk of, and puts beer in it, and just cracks the first one open, starts drinking, and like will not get up from the chair until he's finished like the 10 beers. And he says, by that point, you've written a lot of crap, but you've probably also written something that is refreshing that the next day, once you've recovered, you can go and do. But I've always wanted to try it, never been able to. Because I'd probably just pass out.
Right.
I feel like crack would probably work better for that, though, right?
Mm.
Something to really open it up.
Right.
Not make you fall asleep.
Oh, really?
No, like, I'm assuming the 10 beers, you'd fall asleep.
Right. Oh, exactly, yeah.
By my sixth, I'd certainly be down for the count.
Yeah, I don't think the beers would work for me. I'd get full.
Mm-hmm.
I would fall asleep in my chair.
Yeah, maybe a little cranky, too. Do you guys have a name of the production company, or it's just...
We're just Gagerman and Waller. You tend to, the way that the thing works is that there's a lot of writing teams, and they're all sort of known by their somebody and somebody. So like, there's another team, Gatewood and Tanaka. There's Gagerman and Waller. There's Kurtzman and Orsi are like, the big ones. So there's always, that's the way you kind of go.
Altshuler and Krinsky. I always thought that one had a good ring to it.
Yeah, because when we started writing together, we sat down with a lawyer, and the lawyer said, every place you go, you're going to check in to a meeting. You say, Gagerman and Waller are here. If you call your agent, you tell the assistant it's Gagerman and Waller. You just stamp yourself.
That's just your brand.
So it's your brand.
Yeah. I guess that does sound better than Waller and Gagerman. Gagerman and Waller kind of rolls off the tongue easy, huh?
That was, yeah, I mean, that's the way we came up with it.
Yeah. Yeah. It was not a power dynamic thing. Also, it does seem to be alphabetical does seem to be the standard for some reason. Is that true?
Yeah, I think maybe.
Got it. So what's like fascinating you guys recently?
In the world, in general?
Yeah.
Andrew recently has gotten really into craft beer and sports, which is weird because I was always the one who was into sports. Mm. And then I've sort of, and so he is the, like, usually the thing that fascinates us is the first hour of our day, right? It's like the distraction before we work. Mm-hmm. So lately it's been sports scandals, which, you know, that's what people talk about in offices.
Mm. Talking a lot about Billy Ocean lately.
Billy Ocean this week has been big because we've been watching some
we've been
Billy
watching
Ocean
like we were like what ha-, you know, for this is the way it starts. What happened to Billy Ocean, right? That's the question that I feel like your listeners are mm-hmm. dying to know. And it turns out like Billy Ocean looks fucking awesome is what he's doing. He like literally he's got this like amazing mane of white hair and he's like doing legacy shows like all over Britain. His voice is like butter. It's amazing. Silky smooth. I watched him do Suddenly recently, acoustic. I mean, it was remarkable. And I'm just sort of like, oh, like, what's that guy up to? And then, and that can spur, hey, you know, an idea. Like, oh, what is Billy Ocean doing? Like, who's Billy Ocean's manager? What's that like? Mm. Who else does Billy Ocean's manager manage? Would that be a good TV show? Like, that sort of first hour can lead to those sort of discussions. Or it could just lead to us watching a lot of Billy Ocean. But it's pretty awesome. And by the way,
either way, it's a win.
My question is, why can't I find him doing? I want to ask Billy Ocean why he doesn't do Get Out of My Dreams, Get Into My Car.
He stopped playing that.
Well, I haven't seen. I went on my YouTube searches, have not been able to find a more modern version of that. I'd love to see his like slowed down, like acoustic version. That would be great.
Have you guys seen what's happened with Billy Corgan?
No.
You know, sure. Smashing Pumpkins.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's gone off on some weird bit. He owns this wrestling franchise, but he's also I heard
like a wrestling league,
like a mini WWF,
okay.
Where he owns that and he gets into that. And you see these pictures of him like holding these wrestler belts,
yeah.
And there was some conspiracy stuff, but I think it was kind of sad to hear that he has to play all his old hits. But he plays them really fast because he's so sick of them, and so these concerts are like he can't play the new stuff that he wants to. Has to play this old stuff. He says everything's short attention span and you need to get to the chorus immediately. And it just kind of sounded like the opposite of the Billy Ocean story. It sounded like the downward.
And it's
Billy is still enjoying. He is still enjoying Caribbean Queen, but the funny thing is, Mike, you've been looking to diversify your portfolio. We hadn't even thought about like wrestling leagues.
That's a good point. Right. That
put
could
some
be
money into that.
Right.
Just yeah, like, we're like
been,
a
we have been talking about the fact that, like, yeah, we can never seem to rely on, you know, like a job. We need like a turnkey business that we can have on the side. I was thinking of, you know, maybe more like laundromats, but I think maybe a wrestling franchise is
What about G&W Foxy Boxing?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, just sort of like a fun Foxy Boxing thing, because I mean, I feel like interesting people would be coming through the office.
Sure.
Does Foxy Boxing mean models, like women models boxing?
I mean, it's like lady boxing
with like oversized gloves, like mm-hmm. cartoon gloves almost. So there's, you know, less damage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't. Foxy Boxing, I feel like maybe had its day.
Yeah, I think it's done.
I've been taking boxing recently, and it's like a great workout. I want to get in the ring, but the assistant who's at the boxing place I go to, the whole half side of his face is like shut down and messed up. I said, "Is that from a fight?"
He's like, "Yeah." I feel like that's not a good front man for that business,
right?
Yeah, I feel like that person should be in the back doing the paperwork.
It makes me a little concerned to get in the ring, I got to say. And I don't know if that could be surgically changed or if that's just his face now or what's...
Even if it could be surgically changed, I think you should still be concerned about going down that route.
Right.
And what is the what is driving you to want to get in the ring? Is it the, like the personal challenge? Is it to actually hit somebody?
It's all of it. I mean, it's one of the greatest workouts. It's so intense. There's just kind of, I feel like, I don't know.
Adrenaline rush?
Yeah, the adrenaline. But part of me is like reconnecting to this deep primal masculine side, you know, of losing that just wanting to rip something's head off kind of feel.
I don't have a deep masculine side. I really just don't. I'm trying to think if I ever did. I don't think I really did. I get it. I mean, I think it's cool. I just don't.
Well, you have a lot of hair, and that's very masculine.
Oh, thank you.
Well, the one thing that, I mean, you should see Mike's face on the elliptical. I mean, he is a man on a mission.
Really? Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I'm usually listening to Roar, but like, you know, so I don't know how masculine
that is. That's why your face looks like that. It's just like, yeah, Roar is all about just like your inner whatever, your inner beast.
Yeah.
Yeah, you used to listen to those punk bands back in the day, huh? Weren't you?
Yeah,
no
maybe.
Doubt.
No.
No doubt is the punk band he listened to.
In college, it was like all the indie rock bands, which is not very masculine.
Like Pixies, probably. Right?
Sure, yeah.
Not even.
What?
When was the Gin Blossoms?
Sure.
The Gin Blossoms were big.
Look, everybody's got room in their playlist for the Gin Blossoms. I'm going to put that back on my workout mix.
Remember how obsessed we were with Snapple back then?
Sure.
Oh, I did love myself
obsessed.
Some Snapple.
Obsessed? Why?
I don't know. It was juice. We were still children.
It wasn't even juice. It was 10% juice.
Right.
It was water, sugar, and it literally said on the bottle, 10% juice.
Yeah, I think it just felt cooler than soda for some reason, like more adult.
Right.
Well, it had caffeine in it. That was something.
That's and true. It had caffeine, and we weren't drinking coffee yet.
And we needed something to get through those weekends.
Those weekends, right, because those weekends we would just go through cases.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was weird. I was a weird kid, but I was like, I'd be proud of the fact that I drank 6 Snapples in a day.
So Billy Ocean.
Yeah, so yeah, we're burning on Billy Ocean. I don't know. I read a lot of like weird nerd film blogs. That's sort of my poison is the nerd film blogs. I don't know what's Mike's. Mike, you're surfing.
Lately for me it's been a lot of podcasts. So it's been a lot of but it's a lot of weird like nerd political podcasts, nerd history podcasts. I just listened to Book on Tape for the first time in a long time. Really good.
What do you think are some of the factors of the great podcasts you've heard? Like what makes it awesome?
Well, I love the podcasts that do somebody's personal history from, you know, when they were growing up through sort of how they became who they became. Like I like that narrative is something that I and like really get fascinated.
Jeez, I'm picturing if I were to do that, it would look like the scenes where Chunk is captured in the Goonies. Mm-hmm. Where they're like, "Tell us everything."
Everything. There was that time in fourth grade. Like,
that would be me. That would be my story. Yeah, all the embarrassments.
For some reason, when somebody's like, "Oh, who were you in high school?" Mm-hmm. Like, I want to know that. Like, of somebody who's done well, I want to know who they were in high school. I want to know how they got into college, and I want to know how they dealt with their 20s. Like that kind of story arc really kind of interests me.
I think it's a really crafty skill. Like recently Terry Gross agreed to be interviewed by Marc Maron, and that was really interesting because Terry Gross is like this amazing interviewer. She's like amazing at getting people to tell their story, but you know nothing about her. Mm-hmm. And Marc Maron is like much more of a blunt instrument who somehow gets you to reveal things about yourself by talking about himself, which is a completely like almost opposite approach. And so watching him try to like pull things out of her and watching her like very reluctantly give it up was like a really interesting thing to listen to.
Yeah.
I'll put that on my recommend list.
Got it. So what stuff you guys are there stuff that you guys have that's out there right now that we could like even watch on Netflix or anything?
So there's a movie that is in the can, as they say.
Yeah.
It's done, but it hasn't been released yet. We don't have a release date for it yet. It's possible that it can be found, on some pirating website. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's good. Well, but it's called Search Party. It's got the, if you watch Silicon Valley, it's got TJ Miller and Thomas Middleditch in it, Adam Pally, who was great in Happy Endings and the Mindy Project, Alison Brie, and it's a very funny movie. So we're excited to for the world to be able to see
it. That's awesome. And did you guys have influence on that as it's being made, or did you just hand over the script and then you just hope they do something great with it?
No,
it's a good question, because it can happen. That can happen both ways.
Right.
In this case, we'd worked closely with the director in writing it, and so the director is Scott Armstrong, who's a very big screenwriter. He wrote Old School and Road Trip and the second Hangover movie and a bunch of other stuff, and so he kept us very involved throughout the process, but on a business level, we were not involved. On a decision-making, studio level, we were the writers, and we turned it in, and we, finished our rewrite, and we're officially out of it.
Then if you look up on the wall there, there's the Blood Brothers comic book that we wrote for Dark Horse.
Whoa.
It was two vampire buddies who've been friends for 1,000 years, and so they've got a lot of baggage. And they're dealing, they're trying to stop the end of the world, as you might imagine. So we deal a lot in sort of what we call dude buddy comedy.
Uh-huh.
It's mostly dudes who are friends getting in some sort of trouble. So we write a lot of that.
When's the last time you two got in trouble?
Got in trouble.
Yeah. You mean not like just with our wives for being late?
Right.
You mean that's real trouble?
Yeah, like.
Oh, that's a good question.
Because it seems like that needs to happen if that hasn't in a while.
It hasn't happened in a while. Mm-hmm. It's funny because that's, that goes back to to those research trips that you brought up. It's, and we have not, I think we have plans to get in trouble when we approach a new idea. We're like, we should go down to Tijuana and see what kind of trouble we can get in. And we're at a point in our lives where something gets in the way and we say, no, we're not going to do that.
It sounds exhausting.
Yeah, just tired just thinking about it. So we don't get into a lot of what you would call real world trouble.
Got it. Well, I hope you do.
Yeah, I'm really disappointed in that answer. I feel it.
And why are all of the Mr. Men and little misses on the wall?
So what happens, one of the other things that happens is people have ideas and they'll come to a group of screenwriters and say, hey, we have we have an idea, or we have a property, we'd like, somebody to adapt. And so we'll be, asked to come in and deliver our sort of take on that material.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one where they were asking, somebody has the rights to the Mr. Men franchise.
Come and dance for us.
Yes.
Oh, wow. So is that going to happen?
That one's like in process.
Wow.
We've done, we've met with the rights holder, or with the studio, and,
you sort of have to work your way through the system
as
you do that. And as you can see there, we have the Laker girls on the wall. We're hoping to do a Laker girl project. Not really. The Laker girls are just randomly on the wall.
You guys ever do improv?
Never.
No.
Never.
Have you ever tried?
Mm-mm.
No. I've been meaning to sign up for a class for about 2.5 years. And there's like 4 within a 1 mile radius of here, and I haven't made it. Have you done improv?
Oh, yeah. I love it.
Oh, that's right. We saw your stand-up.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right. That was good.
But
it was
that's
fun.
A different muscle
right? It feels like a completely different muscle.
Yeah.
Completely different.
I think we would benefit from that because it's a different way to generate ideas.
It's so good. I think you guys would really get a lot out of it.
Now, do you think we should do it together, or do you think we should sign up separately?
Whichever way you will do it, however you like, if
whatever
it takes
gets
you
it done.
Yeah, whatever gets it done.
Okay. And how has it helped you?
It
helps you say yes to things.
Yeah, like say yes. But also just
not a big improv. Yeah,
well, yes,
it's yes,
yes
and.
Yes
and.
And
it's amazing how much it applies to life. Just not going counter to things.
Right.
And just going in the direction. And, we're going this way, let's just keep going this way.
So it's a flow thing.
It's a flow thing. It's
a
total
we could
flow
use
thing.
That.
Yeah, flow hack.
I feel like there was a lot of, it was interesting because I went to film school, so there were a lot of, we actually took a bunch of acting classes. And it was always fun, but it was definitely, it felt, the acting classes that they had at USC were always, felt more old school acting, and it wasn't a very improv-based education.
Yeah.
It was more like you read the text.
Yeah.
Were you good at it?
I was, I would say, decent. I mean, I don't know, honestly. It's funny because the times when it would flow too, it's like the audience disappeared and I wouldn't even hear laughter. And somebody would say, oh, that was so funny. I was like, it was. But you're just so in the moment. And the weird thing about improv too that I think like you guys would really enjoy figuring out as well is that it's always surprising what's funny.
Right.
You know, you'd say something and be like, wow, I didn't realize that was funny. And things that you think are funny are not. And it's almost this live test environment of humor.
That makes a lot of sense. I think it would help a lot. I think the thing keeping me from it is like I have a really high shame quotient. Like I'm just easily embarrassed.
Yeah.
I think just over the course of this conversation, there's probably been four things that I've said that I'm immediately mortified about. And so doing an improv class, especially early on, is really going to raise the bar on that, where I'm just constantly going to be ashamed of myself. And while that might be a healthy thing for me, it's a hard thing to jump into with 2 feet.
I get it.
I don't think you need no more shame in your life.
Thank you.
It's weird how it's one of those things where,
as freeing as it might be,
it makes it go away quicker. Like I found it's much improv. I found to be way easier than stand up. But with stand up, the interesting thing was because when you're on improv there, especially with if you're with good players, they'll save you and they'll be there for you. But even if you're not, it's at least you're in it together, right? But stand up.
But what if there's like one guy who really sucks? Are you still
sucks.
In it? Are you still in it together?
No, not really. I mean, that really sucks when they won't go for it, and they're not listening and they're not paying attention. And
there's a good
really...
Broad City about that. You
Is
ever
there?
Watch Broad City?
Oh, I've seen clips that I love. I got to watch it more.
There was an episode where the one of them was dating the guy who was just the shitty improv guy that was just ruining it for all the other improv guys.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I would be that guy, but I certainly could be.
Yeah. I mean, the advantage is that it's around people you don't know, and it's over in a second, and it's done, and then you're on to the next thing. It's like, I think it's the fastest shame processing ever, because you just go through it, and then it's over, and then you're done.
Right, right. Although I feel like if you take the class, then you're going to do it, and then you have all week until the next class to try to redeem yourself from the horrible thing you said the week before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's funny to hear you say that because, like, I haven't heard anything you said today that sounds shameful at all.
I'm sure it doesn't, but that doesn't keep me from reliving it in my mind and being like, oh, that
got
was
it. So you must enjoy that on some level.
Some level I haven't yet discovered, maybe.
Because why would you do it otherwise?
Why would I do what?
Like, even replay it on your mind or do that kind of thing. It must have some
so you
kind
think,
of anxiety.
Oh, you think, yeah, you think Mike's shame spiral is like somehow like something he enjoys?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder that when we write our scripts, because frequently, you know, because part of the thing is, you know, our scripts, like, we'll sit there and we'll go over every single line. Like, it's very rare that we would hand anybody a script where every line hasn't been over, you know, half a dozen times.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just sort of part of who we are, that there's something about locking something in. And that if there were a line in there that hadn't been gone over or did read weird when I read it later on, I would feel like, oh, what happened there?
Yeah.
It's like a perfectionist thing or something.
Right.
That's the problem.
Mm. Yeah. So we're coming up on about 48 minutes. We tend to do these till about, you know, 50 minutes or so. I'm curious, since you guys listen to a lot of podcasts,
yeah,
have you found that there's an ideal size? Because some people will do these 20-minute, just straight to the point. Others, like Joe Rogan, can go 2.5 hours sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like, what have you found in your listening?
I find I don't mind the ones that go long. If I'm not super interested, I'll
just stop.
Turn it off. I think there's something sort of senseless about having a time limit, because part of what's freeing about the medium is that you're not subject to whatever the time slot is.
Totally.
So I think it's silly to have a set time, particularly if I'm not saying this is one that would go on and be interesting for 2.5 hours. But if you were talking to someone more interesting than we are, there'd be no reason to cut it off. And I would stick with it as a listener. And who cares if I didn't?
Right.
If it's interesting to you, you should keep going.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seems like the ones that are like, you know, that are like 45 minutes or are good to listen to in two two chunks. So mm-hmm. it would be the hour and, you know, the 45 minutes and then the whatever that is, hour and 20 minute ones.
Yeah.
I think it depends also on the type. The ones that are more informational, yeah, I want those to be like, okay, I'm gonna devote 30 minutes
right.
to learning about this thing.
Yeah. I don't listen to any podcast that's under 30 minutes. I would say that.
Mm.
Not on purpose, but it seems like none of the ones that I listen to and that like are like little tidbits.
Yeah.
You know, they're all something where people are sinking into discussions.
Right.
I did happen to listen to an 8-minute podcast this morning, but it was one of the Slate podcasts they do. It's called Listen Up. They do a sports one. And so they just did a special bonus 8 minutes to talk about that Sepp Blatter, that sort of horrible human being who had to step down from FIFA.
Mm, right.
I don't know if you followed that story. Uh-huh. It's an interesting one. And so that was really more of just a bonus. Hey, let's talk about this one issue. Usually right. that would be one of three issues in a 45-minute podcast.
Yeah.
So you probably are in the right place.
Yeah. Well, is there anything that you guys would want to say to our millions of listeners while you have them on the line here?
No, I mean, I think if you are interested in writing, I think that the best thing you could do is just to start writing. That would be my big,
no, it's the biggest. I remember that I have it in the beginning of my book. I said the biggest tip I got was from my friend Chance, who said, the secret I have to writing is the only one you don't want to hear. And I'm like, what? He's like, just write it. And you're right. That's it. You just write.
You have to, and you have to write something bad before you can write something good.
Yeah.
By the way, I'm always impressed by the people who are like, I had five scripts in a drawer. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure I would have died if it took us five scripts. It took Mike and I, the script that sold was our second script together. And I feel like if it had been that
between
many
us,
more,
we might have five or four before, you know. Before we had started writing
That's
together,
fair.
We each wrote a couple.
Right, right.
And, you know, but you always, I think, yeah, the thing is you have to also start writing, you have to start writing the next one before the first one is complete.
Right.
You can't, if you focus entirely on one thing and you play it out to completion, and if it's something that you're trying to sell and you go out and you try to sell it and then fail, it's really hard to then start the new thing.
Yeah.
When you're close to finishing something and you're feeling good about it, that's when it's a really good time
to start
to think about the new idea, because yeah. you can use the energy, the finishing energy, to start something new.
That's awesome.
That is awesome.
It's amazing. We should do that one time.
Yeah.
Well, now you guys can take all the awesome energy from this podcast, and once I leave, you guys can just take that energy and
straight to lunch.
Go to lunch. Yeah, I don't know what he's doing. He's meant. We listen, we're up early with the kids, so, you know, 11:30 is like when we start talking. Hey, are you hungry? Oh, well, yeah, I'm hungry. Where's a good sandwich? We go to the sandwich place.
Nice. Well, thanks for being on the podcast, guys.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yeah, everybody, you can see more at culturehackers.com. And as we said in the last episode, love to hear feedback. So if you're hearing it all the way to this end, you can email me at robert@cultureblueprint.com. And would love to hear your feedback. And please rate us on iTunes as well. See you next episode. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.